Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast. And wow, what a week in British politics. Since you last joined us, we had a general election on Thursday when Theresa May's majority in the House of Commons was dramatically reduced. Everything inextricably linked to Brexit. So what now? What's the way forward? Well, we're joined by Lembit Opic for today's episode, and he's going to talk us through what he foresees happening, where the Tories got it a little bit wrong, and where the DUP can now step into the fray. If you've got any feedback, we'd love to hear it. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can leave some comments. And if you wouldn't mind going to iTunes and leaving us a review, that would be very much appreciated, as it really helps to boost the show's ratings, and we do try and stay independent with everything. Other than that, enjoy the show, and now over to Lembit.
So it's a handful of days before Brexit negotiations kick off again in earnest, and Theresa May's best laid election plans have gone up in smoke. After last year's renewable heating incentive scheme shambles in Northern Ireland, she at least has one thing in common with a party where she's off to make a pact. Who better to try and make sense of it all than friend of the podcast, Lembit Opic. Lembit, welcome back to the show. First question, how are you?
I'm in much better state than British politics, and it's been a long time since I've been able to say that, sir.
Yeah, it's all a slightly confusing at the moment, isn't it? I mean,
It's not confusing. It's very simple. Theresa May completely cocked up the general election. She got tens of millions of pounds from sponsors and blew it all to get rid of her majority. It's very simple to understand what's happened. Very hard to understand why she did it.
Yeah, what's your hunch on that one then?
She miscalculated monumentally. This is obviously going to be relevant to the Brexit talks. But she used Brexit as an excuse to have a general election which was theoretically banned. By that I mean we have something called a fixed-term Parliament Act that is meant to say we have elections every 5 years instead of whenever a Prime Minister feels like it. She thought she knew better. She provoked the opposition into the impossible situation where they basically had to agree to have a general election, which looked like it was going to be terrible for the Labour Party. And lo and behold, Jeremy Corbyn isn't quite as terrible as they were suggesting. And Theresa May wasn't quite as great. Result, working majority for the Conservatives becomes an unworkable minority without help from Britain's fourth party, the DUP.
As it won't be one thing that people are united on is that Theresa May made a bad call in calling this election. So, but
that is the euphemism of the year. That's like saying that the captain of the Titanic made a slightly careless slip up on the way to America.
Okay. I sense a little Schadenfreude in some of your responses.
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Now, look, let's try and keep it on to Brexit if we possibly can. But so if they go and form an alliance with the DUP, that gives them enough seats to have a working majority at this stage. The DUP were the only pro-leave party in Northern Ireland. Tories are pro-leave. So can't we still push on with Brexit?
All of what's gone before in our conversation is directly relevant to Brexit as it happens. And let's look at the implications of what I think was her error of judgment. She claimed that she wanted a stronger hand for the Brexit negotiations. She blamed the other parties for making it necessary for her to test the will of the people in order to give her that majority. But we all know she thought that she had a huge majority and therefore, a huge advantage in the polls, which would give her a huge working majority. Now, I've got to stress this again. She wanted that majority so that she could drive the best deal for Brexit that she possibly could. That's the context. Let's look at what happened. As you rightly point out, she can't govern on her own now. She threw away the working majority. I'd love to hear the internal conversations in the Tory party right now. and she looks like she's gone cap in hand to the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party. Is that good or bad? Well, it's very bad for the Conservatives. Catastrophic for Theresa May's own political reputation because of what she's done. And great for Northern Ireland. You say the DUP is pro-Brexit, but in reality, I think even the DUP recognises the massive amount of funding that Northern Ireland has received for fairly obvious and pragmatic reasons from the European Union. So now she can't just satisfy and please herself as she wants, as she thought she would do with the big majority. She has to ask the DUP permission. And therefore, she's not negotiating with the European Union. She's negotiating with her own, let's use the word, coalition. Yes, I use the C word.
Yeah, yes, the coalition of crackpots and chaos, as I've heard it termed.
I detect a hint of schadenfreude in your voice.
No, this is just, I'm purely reiterating. I mean, Alistair Campbell, for example, he's just one of a few commentators that have been really strong on this. It's squalid, it's disgraceful that they should never be jumping into bed with the DUP on this.
Well, that's,
why do you believe they say this?
Well, in Alistair Campbell's case, it's because he was the architect of New Labour. You wouldn't expect him to be saying, well, let's give Theresa May an easy time. Perhaps more interesting is what Nigel Evans, who is a senior Conservative, former Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons, said. He said that the Conservatives had shot themselves in the head. It's the fact that Conservatives themselves admit and without any provocation claim the position has been terribly weakened for Theresa May. Let's try and get the hyperbole and the schadenfreude and everything else out of the analysis now. What does it really mean? For me, what's now happened is a significant weakening of the credibility, not just of Theresa May, but of the United Kingdom in the eyes of the European Union. In a sense, it was turned into a referendum on Brexit by none other than Theresa May herself, and that's a tremendous irony. It could be argued by the Remainers that the fact she couldn't sustain a majority over Jeremy Corbyn, whom she and others claimed was a terrible and weak opponent, meant that the public were a bit fed up with the whole thing. I think it's dangerous to overplay that because a lot of other factors were at play as well. But in theory, at least, you could say the need for a strong Brexit deal wasn't enough to secure a majority for the Conservatives. Therefore, the EU can point at what happened and said, well, Theresa, you wanted a big mandate for the Brexit deal. You didn't get it. Maybe you should think again. At the same time, of course, the Brexiteers are very annoyed about it. Those who wanted a hard Brexit can see that it's much more difficult to do that when you depend on 10 Northern Ireland politicians to prop up a minority government. So what's going to happen there? And then the third problem, she's got Eurosceptics as well as she's got Remainers on the backbenches of her own party. And they have much more power in the current situation than they had even when the Conservatives had 331 seats. So problems abroad with credibility, problems internally to maintain stability, and problems bilaterally to keep the DUP on side, who can pretty much write their ticket now, and they can do for the next 5 years.
Yeah, and on writing that ticket, I think European Union has put to the fore that the border issue in Ireland, also the free trade across that border, is two really important points to be addressed. Now, you mentioned there that the DUP, although, yes, nominally they were for Brexit, actually it's a lot softer Brexit because of the amount of funding that comes from the European Union. So therefore, what whip hand can they play in practical terms over Theresa May's government?
I've been the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland for 10 years in the past, and I've dealt with most of the politicians we're talking about here. I have a huge respect for the DUP and Northern Ireland politicians as a whole. They've operated in a hothouse which is more heated, more intense, and actually more dangerous than any other place in the whole of British politics. And that teaches you stuff. It teaches you to be canny, to be smart, and to be a good negotiator. Therefore, it would be a fool who underestimates the DUP's capacity to drive home their advantage. What might they ask for? Well, four things. Number one, funding for Northern Ireland. They have 10 out of 18 MPs. and therefore they can say that they speak for the majority in Parliament for Northern Ireland. And that means it's a practical price that Theresa May will have to pay for things which may not be directly related to Brexit. It could be about hospitals and everything else. We don't need to list that now. It's not what we're mainly discussing. Second thing is about Brexit. It's about that border. Contrary to what many people said, the UK does have a land border with the European Union, and that's between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland. And they'll want to set demands about what that border represents and how it's treated. And that means in a constitutional way as well as in a practical way. It'd be interesting to see if they want to have a solid border, for example. The third thing, and then now it gets really interesting, is what trade agreement has done with the South. The DUP are smart. They know that millions of pounds go both ways across that border. They'll want to protect that. And this leads to the fourth one. Whatever they agree there is essentially an agreement between the UK and the whole of the European Union. If you sell a banana across from the north of Ireland to the south of Ireland and you don't have to pay a tariff, that means there is a way to get tariff-free trade from the UK to the European Union. And it's an easy step to see how that could then be taken advantage of, exploited, to go between the EU and the whole, the UK and the whole of the EU, the other 27 countries. And therein lies the problem for Theresa May, because it's very hard to see how you can protect the relationship between the north and the south at the same time as not compromising any kind of separation of the markets of the UK and elsewhere, and perhaps the most difficult thorny issue of all, the concept of limiting freedom of movement.
So from your point of view, this DUP coalition could be quite a positive step.
For those who are in favour of a soft Brexit or even of remaining, they will watch with interest to see what the DUP say on this. I could be wrong, they could take a dogmatic position and say they want a Mexico-US type physical wall there, which is guarded. They might say that they insist on having some kind of trade barrier between the north and the south, but I just don't feel that's intuitively where they are. They do work closely with Sinn Féin, and that's going to be a factor, and Sinn Féin would, of course, oppose that kind of thing. The waters are at the very least muddied, and at the very most for Remainers, deflating the idea of a hard Brexit. Now, let's look at it from the other side. If you are a hard Brexiteer, if you could convince the DUP to take that really, really tough line, then you'd have to also give them a game plan on how to maintain relations within the province itself. It may not be a war of guns, but it's still a war of words. And if you push this too far, it'll look overtly as if the UK is walking away from any chance of united Ireland. That is a high-stakes game, which literally involves life and death consequences. After the amount of blood that's been spilled over there, I think any government which begins to physically separate the north and the south is walking on eggshells. It's very, very dangerous territory indeed.
And that's some of the vocal criticism of, you know, Theresa May's sort of willingness to step in with DUP is because on that very point, isn't it? That's the big risk factor that people are talking about.
That's right, for all the reasons that I've said, and I don't need to repeat. But her first priority at the moment is to try to stabilise an unstable situation. Once again, how ironic is that? And to strengthen a weak position. The only way she can get away from weak and unstable government is by trading on her domestic political security in exchange for something to the DUP. But inevitably, that crashes against her promises about a hard Brexit. How do you square that circle? This is one of those times when I'm going to get a deck chair, some sandwiches, and sit right next to the ringside and watch to see what Theresa May does of it when she takes on not just the challenges abroad, but the challenges at home, entirely of her own making.
Before we just finish with the DUP, I guess what muddies the waters even more is that there are elections in Northern Ireland after the heating scandal that we sort of touched on right at the top. Who's governing in the power sharing agreement, that's not really clear at the moment either, is it? Can you explain that situation?
There's a great phrase which goes, anyone who isn't confused by the Northern Ireland situation, doesn't fully understand what's going on. And I think, therefore, it is an act of great optimism to think that I could explain in a few words or even a few hours exactly what's going on. But let me give you a simple version.
Thank you.
The DUP, well, see if you still thank me once I've given it. The DUP and Sinn Féin are the two big beasts in Northern Irish politics. By a miracle of negotiation, they have found a way to work together, and much has been written of that. But they're still in competition. And with the DUP on 10 and Sinn Féin on very close to 10, 7, their big game is to try and win control of the Northern Ireland Assembly. That's the devolved assembly that has a lot of power over Northern Irish politics. They can't drop the ball domestically for them for the benefit of Theresa May. It just would be political suicide for them. Therefore, their next focus is to see how they can manoeuvre for the best deal possible in a province which in majority voted to remain in the European Union. That means that whatever the DUP's views, they have to not put off Remainers during this election. At the same time, Sinn Féin have no trouble saying they're Remainers. No trouble making promises to do the best they can to connect the North and the South. That is a triangulation which is both fascinating and very challenging. Not so much for Sinn Féin, but for the DUP. Sinn Féin have said to me, I was over there recently a few weeks ago, and they said to me, their aim is to be the largest single party. They might just pull it off if the DUP slip up on their position with regard to looking too tough in favour of Brexit. What does that look like in practice? The DUP, who will be in the blessed and cursed position of having the ear of the British Prime Minister, will have to show that Northern Ireland has nothing to worry about if the DUP has power in the Northern Ireland Assembly at the same time as within the British government. So you can see the sensitivities there without going into more detail on it. And therefore, I think there is a pressure on the DUP to drift it more towards a reassuring pro-European position. Otherwise, they'll have the political rug, the ballot rug, pulled from under them by Sinn Féin.
And just quickly, what is your view on some of the allegations there that they are less than progressive, that sort of flat earth thing, no same-sex marriage, anti-abortion? This seems to have flared up an awful lot in the last couple of days. Is there as much truth in that, or is it headlines?
There's quite a lot of truth in the fact that a large proportion of DUP support has got what might be regarded as traditional and sometimes religiously based positions. Homosexuality has been a big issue and continues to be one in Northern Irish culture. But at the same time, let's remember what was said about Jeremy Corbyn. He's a terrible leader. He's ineffective. That somehow his former relationship with Diane Abbott was relevant. But Corbyn has been the most successful Labour leader since Tony Blair. In the same sense, the DUP have got 10 MPs in Northern Ireland. If you want to snipe at them from the outside, it probably means you haven't bothered meeting them on the inside of the province that they enjoy great success in. Sinn Féin tend to be more progressive in many ways, but once again, they've got different nuanced positions on a number of things, including some of the social points that you make. So I don't think that's a player. I think that's the chattering political and journalistic classes in places like London not bothering to understand the deeper issues at stake here. And remember, the harshest judge of the DUP would be Sinn Féin. And the late Martin McGuinness and the late Reverend Ian Paisley, who were the doyens of their respective sides, were known as the Chuckle Brothers because of their strong relationship. So let's put that to the side. The big game here is how Brexit plays out for the UK on the basis of what particularly the DUP has to say in Northern Ireland to achieve its domestic political objectives.
Yeah, and on the subject of Brexit, once the Great Repeal Bill kicks in and we start and having to unpick all the EU legislation, it's going to fall over quite quickly, isn't it? With such a small majority for the Tories, and therefore, is it not another general election quite close around the corner?
As you can see, I might be arrested for my thinking. as I stand outside here, but I'm going to say my heretical thought anyway on that. The Great Repeal Bill might need to be renamed the Middle-Sized Repeal Bill, and then the Teeny-Weeny Repeal Bill, as all of these pressures come to play. There has been a grandness of statement from Theresa May, starting with the utterly tautological Brexit means Brexit, which rather entertainingly, one of my political friends said live on air incorrectly is Brexit means breakfast. Well, it might be a dog's breakfast now. The repeal bill is beholden not just to the interesting Northern Ireland situation, it's also now beholden to those rebellious backbenchers who never really wanted to leave the European Union anyway, and to the simple fact that Theresa May's own political standing has been vastly reduced by her political blunder, her multi-million pound political blunder with her own party. She's there now almost as a caretaker leader, whatever people say. If she carries on as Prime Minister, it's because the powers that be in the Tory party, which is the most ruthless party in British politics, they're very, very good at that, because those powers have said, we'll keep her there for now and then we'll work something out later. That's not a strong position to negotiate a repeal bill, which the Prime Minister herself was against in the first place.
Mm. And those powers then in the Tory party, you say, are so ruthless. What is that? That's the collective that served under May, or is it people working in the shadows? Who are these people?
The people who operate and run the Conservative Party are obviously the financial backers. The institutions in this country, I would imagine including the Masons, who have tremendously close connections with the Conservatives. And then thirdly, the angry members of Parliament who feel compromised by the loss of their working majority and its replacement with, by any other name, a coalition. So she's going to have to try and pacify the 318 MPs that are left. She has to pacify the angry membership base who are compromised in a dozen constituencies which were lost because of all of this, more in fact than a dozen. And then she's got to look outside to the backers who say, Theresa, you've just blown our money to put us in a weaker position with regard to Brexit. You need to now deliver these goods for us, and if you don't, then you're out. And that's the problem, that's the confounding factor here. Theresa May has now opened up different fronts that she has to fight, rather than having this one core objective, which is to make sure the country's ticking along okay while getting us out of the European Union.
Yeah, I spoke to a German analyst quite recently, and it was interesting when she was talking about Angela Merkel and how many things that she's got on her plate at the moment before she even gets round to bothering thinking about Britain's relationship with the European Union. And it's sort of the way you're speaking now, it's almost as if May has just picked up a mountain of tasks before to think about, as well as obviously Brexit negotiations, which are kicking off in just a few days' time.
In the past, Theresa May could get up in the morning, have a look at the most recent data on the UK polling report website, which for her would have been a delight to have a look at, 16 points ahead, 20 points ahead. And then she would have wandered down to Parliament to get her working majority to vote more or less any way she wanted them to, as long as she didn't go too far. Now she gets up in the morning, avoids the polls, tries to forget the headlines from the 8th of June onwards, hopes that there aren't angry letters in her inbox from former enraged, livid Brexiteers who backed her in good faith, and then thinks, well, once I've got all that done, who else do I have to keep calm so that I don't get booted out of my job? So Angela Merkel has political challenges, but they're not of her own making. Theresa May has very political challenges, many of which have nothing to do with running the country, but her own personal survival, and that's not a healthy place to be.
Now, I do want to... It is interesting listening to you talk about May, and I do want to touch on your view on personalities involved in elections in general in a second, so I know you're quite a cerebral thinker. But there's one party we haven't mentioned yet, and that's the Liberals. Now, given they were really the main remainers in all of this, and their position was quite clear, 48% of people voted Remain. Probably a lot of young people didn't vote and would have chipped in and added to that as well. It didn't really make the inroads in the election that perhaps they could have done, did they?
This is the amazing thing about what happened on June the 8th. The Lib Dems bet everything on 48% of the electorate, a little bit of personal vote here and there, but mainly on the Remainers, who they hoped were so angry about leaving the European Union that they would vote for a lot more Lib Dems to halt or obstruct the process.
Yeah.
What actually happened that night was really quite terrible for the Lib Dems. They started with 9. They lost 5 of those 9. And then they got 8 other seats, some of which they'd previously held, back into the fold. There's no real evidence that the British electorate felt that they wanted to sweep in the Lib Dems on account of their Remain stance. It was a consistent stance to take, even if I had some issues with it in terms of the electoral validity of asking for a best of three situation virtually with the referendum. But Tim Farron got sidetracked on other things, which weren't really relevant to the debate at all. He got himself into hot water, I think, about his own religious views, and didn't really shut that down. And there wasn't that sense that the Lib Dems were really talking about the core issues that the public wanted to see. So they've ended up with 12 seats. A spin doctor could say they had the biggest percentage increase of any party, up by 50%, but that is 4 seats. And they're not really players in any context because they don't hold the balance of power in any meaningful way in any vote. The DUP do. The DUP are now the second most important party in the UK, I would say. And they've got 10 seats. So I think the experiment has failed. And the remarkable thing is, the Lib Dems failed where Theresa May succeeded in weakening her own Brexit position. And that wasn't done thanks to Tim Farron. That was done thanks to bad judgment. And I think the Lib Dems will slowly ache up in the polls a little bit. They'll get a few more local councillors and so forth, maybe win the odd by-election. But the length of time it'll take them to become a serious political force in the UK, a weighty force that has to be taken into account in votes in Parliament, far exceeds the length of time available for Brexit. So by the time they're up and running, if they can get there, Brexit will be done and dusted, or at least settled as much as it will be, and everyone will have moved on.
Do you have a view whether Tim Farron should stay in charge?
Tim Farron should stay in charge because he hasn't delivered a bad result. In fact, he exceeded my expectations. I didn't think the Lib Dems would even get as much momentum as they have. In fairness, the party's bigger. I think it was very careless to lose the seats that they did. But
including your old friend Nick Clegg.
Nick Clegg, well, you know, I wrote a book about Nick Clegg. I'm going slightly off the subject now, but I wrote a book about Nick Clegg and his leadership, advising him that if he wanted to be the Deputy Prime Minister, he had to resign the leadership of the party, because even David Lloyd George understood he couldn't do both. He resigned the leadership of the Liberals when he became Prime Minister. But no, Nick Clegg knew better. He ignored my book, wrecked the party, lost 49 seats out of 57 in a single fateful night in 2015, and in a sense is the victim of his own decision-making process. Nick Clegg showed no real contrition for any of it, just carried on believing, it seems, that he had a duty or he had a desire to be an overt pro-European, ignoring the fact that he only got elected in 2015, in my view, because the Tories virtually locked up their candidate in Sheffield Hallam, to make sure that Nick Clegg had a relatively easy ride. This time round, being overtly Remain, the Tory electioneers and Tory voters in Sheffield Hallam had no real reason to vote for him, since Tim Farron also said there was no prospect of a coalition. There was no need to have Tim Farron as being influenced by Nick Clegg. So they just hung him out to dry at the same time as the Labour Party vote increasing. So I actually had money on Nick Clegg losing, not because of some vindictive reason, but it was simply obvious to me that Nick Clegg couldn't hold his seat. Now, that is a bit of a digression, but it does show that Nick Clegg, in a seat which is regarded as having voted 2 out of 3 in favour of Remain, still couldn't win on that premise, suggesting to me that he's a victim of his own hubris to an extent. But it also means that you can't save yourself by being pro-Remain in the Remain seat.
Yeah, no, I have thrown out an invite for Nick Clegg to come on the show because it'd be good to hear his side of it. So hopefully he will respond to that one.
He might do. He's got plenty of time now.
Tembit, stop. Right. Now, my final question to you, and actually this is a serious point. You talked about Theresa May there. See, Diane Abbott stood down shortly before the election through ill health. And I think you could visibly see this toll it was taking on Theresa. Are elections just too big a toll for the individuals? I mean, purely from a mental health perspective, and the levels of stress that are heaped on people, and the vitriol and the divisive kind of rhetoric that flies around, it almost feels cruel.
If you go into politics, you have to understand that very little is sacred. Things that are really irrelevant in terms of one's personal life get dragged up. There's a lot of libel, a lot of slander, a lot of careless running down of your family and your friends. Your children can get dragged into it. It is part of the rough and tumble of politics. I didn't like that part, but there it is. I think that our press is pretty amoral when it comes down to these things. They fight like rats in a sack for a declining newspaper market. So I think some of the traditional values that maybe existed a bit more in the past have gone to the wall. But is it too much? An irrelevant question in a way, because it's not going to change. In my opinion, I knew what I was letting myself in for the 13 years I was an MP. And I lost my seat. And at no point have I said, well, that wasn't fair. Whether I think it was a good or a bad decision by my constituents, that's the way it goes. For Theresa May, she took the biggest gamble I've ever seen. It's actually a bigger gamble even than what was bet by David Cameron with the EU referendum, which sort of had a logic to it. Her election was entirely based on shoring up the Tory support that she had. And so if you place a very high bet, then you have to be willing to lose a very large amount or gain a very large amount. It's a bit like a junk bond. The value of her political career has gone down. And it could have gone up. I wouldn't shed too many tears about that. I have very great deal of contempt for a large proportion of our British media and a lot of respect for politicians, including, in fairness, to Theresa May. I'm not saying she's a bad person. I actually underestimated her, and I think she did better as a prime minister than I expected. But then she messed up big time as well. I don't make my politics emotional. I have some fun with it, but ultimately these people are not my enemies. I just disagree with some of the things they do. I was thinking about the burst into Navita song there, but instead of doing that, don't cry for Theresa May. The truth is, she hasn't left yet.
but you might say, hopefully, sometime soon.
Not for me to say, because I'm not going to dabble in the internal affairs of the Conservative Party. One of the elements of our political system is that we don't collectively elect the Prime Minister. That person is appointed by the party that they lead. At the moment, it's Theresa May. I would say they have marked her card now. It's just a matter of time, and it won't be up to her when she leaves. If she tries to stay on too long, she'll be asked to move on once the arrangements have been made. Brexit is a poison chalice now because of the mistakes she made. They might hold her feet to the fire while she tries to sort it out. But there'll be a plan B. The Tories are very robust in their own survival, and she knows that. When she chose this path, and apparently she chose it all the way back to her school days when she told people she wanted to be Prime Minister, she must have known the game. She's been there long enough. And in that sense, what's interesting, not just at the strategic level in terms of what happens next with the Brexit debate, is how one woman who technically has achieved her life's ambition plays the end game, or if it's played for her. That's what makes British politics quirky, unpredictable, and an absolutely wonderful spectator sport.
Thanks, Lambert. Very finally, does Brexit still mean Brexit?
Brexit will always mean Brexit, in the same way that custard means custard, and a pint of beer means a pint of beer. Perhaps, actually, a pint of beer is easier to determine and define than Brexit. The difficulty that Theresa May is, she's using a made-up word to define a process which had some validity, but it's becoming ever, ever more notional as the days go by. So what does Brexit mean at the moment? Brexit means a mess of it. That's right. Probably what it means at the moment.
Well, a pint of beer means a pint of beer, and I think it is time for a pint of beer. So thank you ever so much for joining us today on the Brexit podcast.
Cheers to that.
Thank you ever so much for joining us on the Brexit podcast. Stay tuned for Thursday for the next episode, and then we'll also be back every Tuesday and Thursday with our little half-hour shows to keep you up to date with all the latest Brexit news. As I stated at the top of the show, we'd love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter, and we'd love to hear your suggestions for new guests. We'd love to hear what you think about the show, and we'd love you to go to iTunes and also leave a review, as that helps really boost our profile. Until next time. The Brexit podcast has been produced by Jennifer Hahn, Warren Powell, and Tim Hemming, with our theme music from Kevin MacLeod.